to another BritBlitz.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's returning guests are Toby Poser and John Adams. Welcome to the show.
Good word. We love returning. Please have us return and return and return again.
Yeah.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
You were our first big interview with The Deeper You Dig. And it was a huge moment that I'll never forget because we were sitting in a truck outside of the lumberyard. And here we were. Yeah. And it was an amazing day.
It was so much fun. And you really set the bar high.
Yeah.
You were my first interview of people in a truck. Yes, I've not had that play, and I'm my only people in a truck to be interviewed. So
I think we're gonna maintain that. I think that's yeah.
It's so funny because today we were like, should we do this in the car? I think it was like Pavlovian.
Yeah,
we were gravitating toward a car, but then we decided to do it.
Try to do some good sound and not have cars beeping and whizzing by at the lumberyard.
Well, look, so you've already mentioned we talked originally about The Deeper You Dig. Then we regrouped when you did Hellbender. And then last year we regrouped again when Where the Devil Roams played at Frightfest. Where the Devil Roams is now available on Tubi, and Tubi is now available to UK viewers, which is great news all round for listeners of the BritFlix podcast. So before we get into any details about it, does one of you want to give a brief synopsis as to what Where the Devil Roams is about, please?
Sure. Where the Devil Roams is about a family of murderous sideshow performers as they travel the dying carnival circuit during Depression-era America. That's the gist of it.
Yep. And it's a brutal story about family love trying to stay together against all odds.
You work as a family, the Addams Family being the production company you are, the Twitter accounts, the social media accounts and stuff. So you work with your daughters, Lulu and Zelda. Where did the writing begin for this, and who shares the responsibilities amongst the four of you when it's pen to paper time?
Every movie we make comes from ideas usually come up within the car. And so, there's hundreds of ideas that are come up with. Most of them get bullseyed out, but occasionally someone will say one where it's like, that's the one, because just the timing of it will be right. And Where the Devil Roams was Zelda's idea at the top. And then we all just, it's a shared rugby ball that everybody runs with.
Okay. This is a much bigger production, I think, compared to the previous two, I think it's safe to say, in terms of sort of scale. What do you remember being the main challenges for you as the filmmakers in pulling that together compared to, say, the other two films, which were maybe more contained?
Well, we did have a much bigger cast. We had a lot of extras. I think there were 75 people in the film, which is huge for us. And we were building the sets in our fields. So we live in the boondocks. We got a lot of like woods. And so John was really innovative about like how to change the set to break down all that wood that was either donated or, you know, I don't think we had to buy a cent of the wood. And then and to just kind of reconfigure the carnival stalls and shoot from a different angle. So, but was a big challenge with that was we had started in the fall and winter. Mm. And then we still had some stuff to shoot on the stage we had built for the carnivals. And by then, all this Japanese knotweed, this invasive, horrible Japanese knotweed, beautiful to look at, but... And so it just had grown over everything. So and we were wearing our winter costumes and had to cut down the knotweed and make it look like winter. That was a fun challenge.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing is keeping in your mind all the pieces to each scene because they were often shot out of sequence and out of time. Like we would shoot somebody's like that's what was the. I remember being overwhelmed sometimes with, oh, I know that I need to shoot one more little piece to this puzzle. And what is it? And, oh, and, you know, so that could be kind of overwhelming.
And I think as well as being that much more ambitious production, you added another element to it to make it even more difficult for yourselves. You went for period as well. So what lessons learned and top tips could you offer the low budget filmmaker for achieving good period in your films?
I think it helps to, I mean, in our case, where we live, there are lots of old houses. And John's family who lives around here has a lot of old furniture. So I think I don't think it necessarily takes a lot of money, but if you can like stick with just well-worn pieces, you know, I think as long as we were using old stuff as we could find, we could kind of get by.
Yeah. I mean, we're lucky. I grew up in a house that was 100 years old. It's a rambling old house, and it still has furniture from 100 years ago in it. And wow. Also, my dad had an old 1931 Chevy, and that was the key because a lot of scenes were shot in it, and it's beautiful, beautiful. And plus, we live in a place in the Catskills that also has not changed. We still live on a dirt road, and there's dirt roads everywhere. There's no lines on the road. There's no power lines. If you look at the pictures from this area from 100 years ago, it looks the exact same as now. So that's the greatest advantage.
Okay.
This would be impossible if we had shot in a town or in a city. We could never do that.
Or had to really buy, you know, all the costumes and all the props and furniture. We just let some things act as a star character, like the car, like the houses, like the furniture, and then hope that just the gist of it with the costumes would come by. A few star pieces of costume on Zelda in particular. I was very particular about her wearing proper vintage.
And lastly, I think the real kiss was Trey Lindsay, our fifth family member, who gradually introduced that old film look to the movie. Okay. So that you're watching a movie, it starts out in full color and kind of like just regular cinematography. But by the end of it, you've got an old broken black and white movie, just like the family is now pretty broken too. And so that really helped sell it, I think. I love what Trey did with the film look.
Now, you mentioned the Chevy, which is a bit of a star of the movie, to say the least. For the Venn diagram where filmmaker crosses over with Petrolhead, can you explain the pleasures of this car to the layperson?
Oh my God! Well, I can tell you. First of all, this kind of car has a smell to it that only people who drive an antique car can understand. it's a beautiful mix of gasoline and carbon monoxide. And the other thing about this car is it's freezing fucking cold. Yeah. So it's either super hot or super cold. Whatever the temperature is, that's what the car is. And lastly, it breaks down all the time. So much pushing is required if you want to make a film with a 1931 Chevy.
So the magic of cinema is making it work in your movie.
There was much, much, much pushing of that freaking car.
It was so worth it. I mean, it because it just you couldn't help but get into character just sitting it.
Yeah.
It. It was a beautiful lead actress.
Yeah.
When you're preparing stuff that's in that, like looking at a period, like what sort of research do you do in terms of the sort of language that people use back then? You know, in terms of so you see a lot of films now where people sort of throw it to one side and they go for contemporary language. But did you pay much attention in terms of how people might talk back then compared to now?
Toby ran that show more than any of us. And so you should answer that.
We didn't want to focus too much on it because already we were somewhat anachronistic. We had people with tattoos and piercings. There was something we wanted to sort of transcend the era. But just again, like with the vintage stuff, if you have just a few key moments where you throw in like a fun phrase, like I say, Maggie says to Seven, like a stick of gum, you know, if you just kind of dabble in a few appropriate phrases, you get the gist by. But we didn't think we were really able to make if we were going to go so far as to like think about accent or lilt or make every instant of dialogue, period appropriate, we just would have been wasting our time. We weren't that interested in being sticklers.
Yeah. One last question then about the film. What would, and what, and give you, and you can one each from you. What's the fondest memory from the shoot for you? Looking back on it now, I mean, it's a while back now, isn't it? But you know, what's a fond memory that stands out for you making that film?
I have to say that my fondest memory is the entire time. I miss that movie. I miss it so much. It's the greatest thing we ever did. And it was just a kind of joyful process before Z went off to college. It was, so I can't pick anything in particular because every single memory I can look at, we shot in this house. So I look at the roads, everything. It just reminds me of how joyful it was.
I have to say, I feel the same way. It was really from A to Z, such a wonderful experience. The kind of one where that you just feel like the film begs to be made. Mm. And you're just kind of doing it a favor and making it because it just felt so right from the inception through Zelda's dreams to the first bit of vintage stuff we bought in a thrift store to get ready to shoot it, to get in the Chevy revved up. It was such a pleasure. And the music was a big part of it too. Hearing John write it and then getting to actually bring that music to life on set while we were shooting, it just was a very organic, pleasurable experience.
Yeah. And I'd forgotten about the music. So let's bring that to the center of the conversation. Cause you've always been doing the music. Cause obviously John, your background in music in bands and stuff. And I've often seen talks from people who make music for film. They go, oh God, I wish I could have been involved from the get-go. But obviously you can almost start thinking of music the minute an idea's mooted. Like, you know, over the dinner table, you'd be like, I can hear that riff. I can think that
piano. That's right. We started writing this one super early. What happened was when we knew we were going to make the movie and it started to kick into gear, I wrote three old-timey songs and I played them for the family and we all decided that they really sucked hard. And so we were like, okay, what are we going to do? And we had been, oh, this is where you come in, my friend. You had recommended a band called Pigs, 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 Pigs. And we still are in love with them. And Zelda or Toby was like, why don't we just be completely, what's it called? Anachronistic? Is that a word that you just used, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to use it too, because it sounds smart. When it came out of her mouth, it sounded so smart. I'm going to say, let's do something anachronistic and and make it super heavy. And so we made a super heavy soundtrack that was so fun for us all to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a trick that thingy, what's he called? Stephen Knight, who created Peaky Blinders, which is obviously set in the same, not too different period, really. And I remember one episode where Black Sabbath comes in on the soundtrack and you're like, oh my word. And it works, obviously, you know, because it's still soundtracking what's going on.
And that reverts back to something else you said, which is like by laying down a heavy soundtrack, you're also saying, hey, let's not worry about how completely authentic everything is here. Let's more worry about the entertainment of the story and what it's saying. And so that was, I think the music really helped and people enjoyed it. And again, we enjoyed making it.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you for giving us that insight into Where the Devil Roams. It is available in the UK and everywhere else where you can get Tubi. We're now going to move on to three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Now, you very kindly, the pair of you, given me a list of three. And I know there's been competition for one of them, but I think we'll cover that in the conversation. We'll be doing each film, 5 minutes chat per film, talking about why it's important to you, what fond memories it evokes, etc., etc. And every time we hear this sound, you hear that okay at your end?
Yeah.
That means the 5 minutes are up and we move on to the next film. Does that seem like a fair rules to you?
Yes.
That's a great rule.
Kicking off, Toby, with your first choice, Michael Rich's 1976 Bad News Bears. Now, I didn't recognize the name of the director, and he went on to direct one of a favorite VHS memories of mine, which is The Island from 1980, starring Michael Caine.
Which I have not seen, so putting it on my list.
Put it on your list. But tell me about Bad News Bears. Where does this fit in your film-watching life? Why is this such an impactful film?
because Bad News Bears is like a big middle finger raised with a wad of pink bubblegum someone spat on the baseball diamond, so it has a little dirt in it. And it's just like, it's profane, it's vulgar, it's rude. It's so wrong on so many levels, and it has such a great heart. I just love that film so much. So I would have been 6 or 7 when it came out.
Yeah.
I think I saw it when it came out, which tells you a lot about the 70s. And it is so representative of the 70s, where you just had, as a kid of the 70s, I'm sure John will agree, you just were kind of let loose, you know? And this film is really, I think, a product of its time. Today, if it were made, people would have to be so much more PC, because there's so much wrong about this film. Let me just mention a few things. They would say, your average modern PC person would say, it's racist, it's misogynistic, it's fat phobic, it's, what else am I missing? It's homophobic, it glorifies drunk driving, yeah. It's child abuse. There are so many things that are wrong with it. It makes smoking look cool. But then the things it gets right is it doesn't resort to cheesiness. They lose, spoiler alert. The adults are like worse than the kids. And it's just got a great heart. I love that film. And so it had a big effect on me as a kid. And it does today, where sometimes you just want to make things that aren't so, you know, aren't right.
Yeah, because I guess, I mean, as a child of the 70s myself, we were positively feral, I think, compared to the very, very connected times we live in today, where you could literally know to the square meter where somebody stood now in terms of what they may or may not be doing.
Correct.
So where did you first saw it then, in that sense?
I probably saw it at the Eden Theater, which was about 5 minutes down the road from where I lived, which is where I saw all my movies when I was a kid.
So walk us down memory lane. Take us in through that front door of
Kid. Playing in the morning in the cornfields in good old Amish Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Not Amish. This was, suburbia on the edge of Amish land.
Yeah.
And I couldn't ride my bike on the highway, but my parents could drive us down to the Eden Theater, which I will talk again in another movie today. Mm. You'd get some like cheap popcorn and some Raisinets, and you see the Bad News Bears, and my parents had no problem with it.
Now, I don't know if you want to chip in, John, because I believe this was the one where Toby got the shouted shotgun on this film. So is there anything you can add?
Yeah, that I just love how honest it was. Look, the 70s, it just portrayed us all as kids. We all watched that movie and we all saw ourselves, because every single day you got your ass kicked and you tried to kick ass, but mostly just got your ass kicked. And it was just the way it was. And that's what that movie is about. Not only that, but all the adults were drunk most of the time and smoking cigarettes and letting you hang out, you know, letting you just risk your life every moment. And it was beautiful. And that movie captures the beauty of it so well without any saccharine veneer.
And, you know, the drink driving and the drinking of Walter Matthau's character, apparently he's never seen with the same brand of beer twice in the film. He drinks Budweiser, Miller High Life, Klingers, PBR, Lucky Lager, cool. Mickey's Big Mouth and Coors in the movie, which I need to now go back and see how true that is. Because if that's a fact, I love it.
I believe it.
And also, you know what? The girl is the heroine of the movie. And that was cool. She was the hero of the movie, you know, and it's just a great movie.
Yeah, she's excellent. She's so great.
Amazing.
There goes the alarm. I should add, Toby, that Quentin Tarantino, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Kevin Smith have individually said that this is one of their favorite movies too. So you're in good company. Right.
I believe it.
Right then, John, we're going to jump into your first selection now. Let me just reset my clock. we're going to go to 1975 for the father of the star of Tatum O'Neill's father, Ryan O'Neill, in Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. So tell us, where does this cross your path first time round, John?
Okay, so we lived in the country, so we only had two neighbors, one family that shared the house with us, and then another family that lived about a mile and a half away, and we would walk through the woods to hang out. And we spent a lot of time together. And I remember the oldest boy from the family that lived far away came back and said, "Hey, last night we saw a movie and it was great." And I said, "Well, what's the movie?" And he said, "It's Barry Lyndon." I said, "What's great about it?" And he said, "That you get to see a woman's boobs." And I said, "I've got to see this movie." And so somehow I convinced my mom to take me to this movie. And she was like, "Oh, I would love to take you to this movie because it's a movie that's about history and Ireland and it's going to be great." And, you know, like she had this whole like intellectual idea about what Barry Lyndon was going to be. I just needed to see these boobs. And off we went. And it was a fantastic movie that definitely shaped how I feel about filmmaking, mostly because the whole time I kind of loved the main character, but mostly hated him. Mm. And I found that even as a young kid, amazing. I loved that experience. Barry Lyndon's kind of despicable, yeah, but understood everything that he did. And that's, to me, great filmmaking. And if Toby and I and Zelda and Lulu can come even close to that kind of character development, then everything's good.
I don't know if you know, but part of the filmmaking process they went through is that Kubrick's dogma almost was it had to be either natural light or candlelight. Oh.
Yeah, I've heard that. And that's funny that that's our rule too. No fake lights. Like we never light anything. It's if the sun or the moon's not lighting it up, then we're not going to shoot it. That was really interesting. So Toby and I went back and rewatched it. And first of all, the cinematography is exceptional.
Yeah.
The acting's exceptional. The storyline's exceptional. And it's funny because the sex scene that I went to go see was so short and so quick. And it's like,
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I remember thinking, well, I'm really interested to see this sex scene. Like, and it was so minimal. It was so nothing, right? It's so funny. It's just this quick passing moment where he's kissing these two naked girls.
Do you watch it on a DVD, Blu-ray or anything? Or did it have the interlude? In the version you watch, I'll just play straight through.
I think it did have the interlude. Yes, it did. Yeah. I think it did.
It's one of the little joys I find watching it. Is that just that pause?
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I guess when it was in the cinema, the ice cream people came around in the aisles and were offering you refreshments before you crack on. I mean, I've been lucky enough on the podcast to have a British cinematographer on called Larry Smith, who was Kubrick's DOP on Eyes Wide Shut. But he first started working with Kubrick on Barry Lyndon, and he did some of those tests with the NASA lenses that they had to use to achieve the candlelight shots.
Incredible.
They're gorgeous.
Yeah, the whole thing's incredible. And I also noticed some things that I could tell were new with cinematography, or at least they seemed to be. He loved using this crazy zoom lens that he could shoot like Barry Lyndon way off a mile away. Yeah. And then he could zoom all the way back to show that he was a mile away. So that was pretty incredible that he could start with a portrait of him and then pull all the way back. So you're like, oh my God. Like, so technically, you know, I'm not a big technical nerd, but technically, it was very cool.
And you know, the character Captain Quinn, who's played by the actor Leonard Rossiter, I don't know if you're familiar with the actor by his name. So he, in Britain, he would be well known for what he'd done in sitcoms. Particular, there was one, Rising Damp, it was called, about a sort of comedically corrupt landlord. Oh, there goes the thing. But I will finish that thought. And in for me, I came to this film knowing who Leonard Rossiter was. So I saw this film a lot later in life than when it came out in 75 or even like in the 80s when it first came on video. And seeing Leonard Rossiter steal the show in the scenes he's in is just mind-blowing to me because he's a sitcom guy, not a movie guy, you know, and it's...
He's fantastic.
Right, guys, we're moving on to Toby's second choice now. Are you ready, Toby?
Yeah.
Good. That's good to hear. We're moving to 1955, James Dean, East of Eden. Do you want to tell us about where you how this film comes across your path and why it is such a fond memory?
I wanted to choose this film not because it holds my heart like a film like Rocky would. I'm not talking about Rocky here, but it really had a lasting effect on me. One, I knew why, and the other I'll get to, I didn't know why, but now I do. So I stayed home from school one day, pretending to be sick.
Yeah.
And I ended up watching TV, and on TV came East of Eden. And I, at the end of that day, I knew I wanted to be an actor.
Oh, wow.
I there was something that, you know, it's sort of soapish. I mean, it's got great theatricality. I loved the book, by the way. I loved Steinbeck's book.
Yeah.
I think this veers off from it a lot, but I hadn't read the book then. For me, it wasn't just James Dean's performance. I just loved the emotion and the rawness in the film. It just worked its number on me. And I was like, I want to do that. There was something about, I was a Jewish kid. I didn't grow up knowing about the Bible or even about Cain and Abel. But I loved the like fight between what some might perceive as good and evil. You know, the good son and the bad son.
Yeah.
Loved James Dean's striving to find his identity. And that stuck with me. And now I'll talk about the other reason why this movie meant so much. At the time, too, at probably 12 years of age, I also was trying to find my identity. And fast forward several years, I learned that my dad was not my biological dad 5 years ago. He's my dad, but I was a product of sperm donor.
Okay.
And so there's something that I look back on it now that I really, James Dean doesn't know who his mother is. He really wants to know. I was so intrigued by that back then. I don't think I had a clue of my story, but when I look at that film now, it just really hits me in the fucking gut because I don't know who my biological father is, or he's not living. But I've never known him. What have I gained from him? There was something I was so intrigued by James Dean's needing to know, where do I come from? And this one parent doesn't love me, not my story. But just, it's a great story about finding your identity, finding love. And the emotion of his portrayal of Cal just really hit me. It's too much now when I go back, but at the time it made me want to be an actor. So it's an important film for me.
I mean, apparently John Steinbeck said, Jesus Christ, it's Cal, when he saw James Dean being the character on set.
Oh, cool. And he's not always a likable character. So as a filmmaker now, I love that. It's really important to me that characters aren't cookie cutter. I love characters who challenge me to love them. I love characters who challenge me to hate them.
The director said that it was almost psychotic. He was exactly like the people you see inside asylums, was like his behavior both within scenes and off camera and stuff. He really sort of, and cast members talked about seeing him cry often after performances. So I guess he left it all on the stage floor, as it were.
Yeah, it's funny. If I looked at some clips to refresh my memory, and I feel like, I'm not sure how generous an actor he was as the other actors. They really seem to be listening well. I think James Dean responds well, But I think he jumps on some people's lines. You know, he's so into it that I feel like it's somewhat of a selfish performance for sure. But it worked on me at 12 years of age for sure.
So at 12 years of age, when that seed's planted that you might want to be an actor, do you remember like whether the what was your first time sort of doing acting then after that kind of that thoughts manifesting in your head? Do you remember?
You know, I'd been on some school plays at school and I knew I loved it, but I just don't think I had the confidence to know, oh, that's who I am. That's what I want to be. And soon after that, it was probably when I was a sophomore in high school when I finally really, I had auditioned for a play at school and I got it and I thought, oh, this is it. I'm a sucker. I am so sold. Took a few years.
And just thinking, as a 12-year-old, was you aware that, of how iconic James Dean was as you would be now?
No, I wasn't so aware. And I'll just throw in that same day, I also saw a movie with Christopher Walken.
Finish your thought. Go on.
Saw a movie with Christopher Walken and Susan Sarandon called Who Am I Now? And so by the end of the day, with those two films, it had sealed the deal. I was so sucker punched and sold.
Brilliant. Yeah. Right, John. We're going to jump into your second choice, which is a belter by half in the horror world. I'm talking about Don Coscarelli's 1979 Phantasm, starring Angus Scrimm as the tall man, who I've, while getting ready for this, discovered he's not really called Angus Scrimm. He's really called Lawrence Rory Guy, which has just blown my mind today. But anyway, tell us where Phantasm joins your life bus journey.
All right. So let's go back to, I guess it would be 1979.
That's when the film came out. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 1979. I had a soccer team in Peekskill, New York, all a bunch of crazy characters. We were real, real crazy. We had a coach named Chuck and he was a terrific guy. I can remember, first of all, Peekskill was a very tough city, like little city. And it was scrappy, scrappy, hard, scrappy. And our team was scrappy, hard, scrappy. And Chuck was a scrappy guy, just terrific character. And he drove around in a hearse. And so he had a son, Charlie, and he invited me, Claude DiGregorio, and Charlie to go watch this movie that was coming out called Phantasm. So off we went to the Westchester Mall. I had never seen a horror movie in a theater before.
Wow.
So I went, I was a virgin, and I'm talking, you know, real virgin. And I sat down, and within 10 minutes, I was scared shitless. And the trouble was I didn't want to look like a wimp, but I really wanted to leave. I was terrified of what was happening. Like it just, the storyline just soaked into my soul, especially the kind of mystical esotericness of the tall man, just his acting and the way he moved and the way he talked and the weirdness of the way he was shot scared me to death. And by the end of the movie, I was a broken 12-year-old. And I mean, really broken. But I tried to be brave. I didn't want to. I loved Chuck. He was someone I thought was just a great guy. I wanted to be cool around Charlie and Claude. So I remember we drove home. I remember the heat of the summer. I can remember looking out the window at the road lights passing by and seeing the tall man in every shadow. And they dropped me off at my house, which was a kind of a scary house anyway, but now my house was terrifying. And for a year, I had to set up an old TV at the end of my bed and turn on a light behind my head so I could watch the reflection in the old TV to make sure that the tall man wasn't coming after me.
No way.
I would look at the TV, the empty TV screen, so I could see the reflection of my room in that concave screen.
Yeah.
And I would just look at it until I passed out. And I'd wake up every morning just thanking God that I wasn't caught in the nightmare of what was invented in Phantasm. So it succeeded.
So like when I was 12, there's no way on God's green earth I could have got in to see Phantasm in the UK cinema. So how does a 12-year-old in a mall cinema get to see Phantasm? What just for the British listeners, what was the restrictions or lack of restrictions that meant you could?
You know, that's a great question, but I never remember ever being restricted to anything. Do you?
Well, did you go with the dad?
I went with the dad. So maybe at that time it was rated R, no one under 17 admitted without an adult. So that's what it would be.
Yeah. So in Britain,
we had the adult and he brought us and scared the living crap out of us and scarred us for life, but turned me into a filmmaker. So that experience that was devastating turned out to be the most beautiful thing that could have ever happened.
And I think I've watched it since and it's amazing, but as a screenplay, it's completely illogical. There's no way I could string together the sequences that, yeah, I'm telling a story, but for some reason it works. And obviously for a 12-year-old, and I think I would have been about the same age when I saw it on VHS, you suspend your disbelief because you don't know where real is and not real is like an adult does.
Trey, our effects guy, calls it bending time and bending logic. And he's always saying to me, oh my God, I can see every movie that we make. He says, I can see how much Phantasm affected you because you love bending time and logic.
Well, do you know the other thing I found out getting ready for this, the genesis of the story came to Don in a dream.
Ah, beautiful.
So you're using the same tools as Don to build your screenplay. So I think you're in good company. Right, awesome. Toby. We're going to get on to your final choice now. The blockbuster, the first ever blockbuster, I might add, according to my files. 67 million people in the US went out to see this in 1975, making it officially the first ever what we now call summer blockbuster. I am talking about Steven Spielberg's Jaws. Talk to me, Toby, about where this fits in your film watching life.
Oh my God. Okay. So that same theater, the Eden Theater, 5 miles down the highway. We were probably there to see like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or something, you know, very child friendly. Mm. I went to the bathroom. When I walked back, I stepped into the wrong theater.
Oh, wow.
I told my mom by accident, but it wasn't. I had to know what this Jaws was about. So in 1975, I would have been 6 years old. And it was the scene where the fishermen are out there and the pier kind of cracks and he's in the water swimming his life, you know, swimming for his life back. And you don't see the shark, but it scared the living shit out of me. And I was pretty traumatized. Fast forward a few years, I probably would have seen it in someone's home. Mm. And so that's the cool thing. And that wasn't as formative as that moment in the theater, because it was sort of like one was like the first kiss. And, you know, eventually one day you're going to have sex and it's going to be great. But that first kiss really does a number on you. That's what Jaws was for me. You know, eventually I had sex or I saw
what
Jaws. I waited for you. you know, eventually I got to see it. But the beautiful thing about that movie is because when you're a kid in the 70s and 80s, you see a lot of things on the TV, VHS or cable. When you get older and you get to see it on the big screen or in today's day on these big, beautiful widescreen TVs.
Yeah.
It has this life that keeps going on and on and on. So I could keep discovering it as I would see it on different screens, bigger screens. Even today, we just saw it a couple weeks ago in Martha's Vineyard where it was shot. And it was like discovering it all over again.
Oh, wow.
So I just adore that film. Definitely my first horror film, you know, even though I didn't really think of it back then as being my first. I love the human moments in the film. The scene with Roy Scheider and his son in the dining room when he's like just giving a kiss and the kid's, you know, mimicking his movements. I think influenced us both as filmmakers. We try to have those human moments and character development moments, private moments in our films. It definitely influenced me as a filmmaker. And of course, the humor, the device of hearing the shark through music, but not seeing it, is so clever. The film, and then the speeches, the actors. Don't you love Jaws?
Do I?
Jaws?
I mean, it was my first. It's the first film I ever saw on VHS. You know, the first family that got a video recorder. We went round to their house. We watched recorded episodes of Top of the Pops, which was, you know, a chart TV show. So just watching that on a different day was mind blowing. And then to watch Jaws, it was like me, my brother, my mum, my dad, the mum and dad of whose house it was, the two kids whose house it was, you know, it was an event still, like, because it was such a rare, you know, such a rare thing to be able to do. And also going back to that thing about the 70s, it was rated PG.
Right.
I mean,
it's amazing.
And it still is to this day. It still is to this day.
Yeah. I mean, if you just listen to the soundtrack and you don't even hear Robert Shaw getting eaten by the shark, it's harrowing.
Yeah.
It's so fucking good.
You know, talking about the music, John Williams first presented Spielberg with the music, and Spielberg goes, all right, that's a joke, isn't it? You know, we're not making a comedy. When are you going to do the real music? And something along those lines. And then he kind of corrected himself, and it became obviously an important facet of the movie. Plus, for John Williams, it launched his career as, you know, this is the man for film music kind of thing. But the idea that, I mean, just goes to prove, you know, that whole, the old adage of no one knows anything. It's like, you know, you cannot see genius when it's in front of you. Everyone else has to work that out for you. And then the other one was just thinking of like what you talk about when you're making your films, the prop for the fake arm scene in the film on the beach. There's like an arm on the beach. I'll just stop that for a second. That time's up. The fake arm looks so bad. He got one of his crew to be buried under sand, and it's a real arm that's sort of pretending to be a severed arm. Which, you know, you kind of get, you're always, and I guess in filmmaking, you're always solving problems that, you know, budget and studio, it doesn't matter, because there's always going to be a problem you didn't foresee, and then there's a solution that you're going to have to do on the hoof. And to hear,
and they're often better than what you were planning. I mean, that's like, that we come from the school of happy accidents, man. Absolutely. And
I do like this trend, though. Murray Hamilton's the anti-hero of the movie, the guy who plays the mayor. And I don't know if you've seen the slogan T-shirts now that are knocking about, which is the mayor from Jaws is still the mayor in Jaws 2. It's important you vote in the next election.
I haven't seen that.
That's great.
So, John, we get to your final choice. 1982, Ted Kotcheff, who directed one of my all-time favorite movies, Waking Fright, starring Sylvester Stallone, Brian Dennehy, and the late, great Richard Crenna as Troutman. I'm talking about First Blood, the original Rambo movie. Do you want to talk us through how this arrives at your door and what impact it has on you?
Yeah, we went out to watch this one in high school. And what I love about Rambo, and I noticed it when I was a kid, was it felt super real. Like, they shot in a dirty town. It was rainy and misty. It didn't look Hollywood lit. A lot of it was shot in the woods. Mm. Rambo, you know, Sylvester Stallone, who could have gone right to some kind of like super well-lit, cheesy, starry movie. He took this kind of dirty role where he's a bit like, he is the hero, but he's also kind of dark. Mm. And then Brian Dennehy. I think that could be the best acting I've ever seen in my life. I every time I watch it, I'm like, my God, he's so good. He's just so good. And I think it has a huge effect on us, on me as a filmmaker, because of their loyalty and their honesty and their genuine take on nature. A lot of the movies shot of him in caves, of him out in the woods, of him riding motorcycles, like through the ravines. Even when he arrives into the town, it's a great like entrance into a town that like I grew up in, a dirty ass out there town that isn't dolled up. It's not, doesn't look fancy. They're not hiding anything. The cracks are there. The townspeople look like townspeople. The cops are just regular old sheriffs. I just love the tone of that movie. I think it's incredible. And I've heard that when Sylvester Stallone saw the first cut, he tried to buy the whole thing because he thought it was a fucking disaster.
Oh, really?
And that is, he's like, it was something like 2.5 hours long. And he was like, okay, him and his agent thought this will be a career killer. Let's just buy it and tank it and bury it. And they wouldn't sell it. He asked them to recut it with him less in it. Wow. And less talking. And I don't know. I mean, what do you think? I think it's just a gorgeous movie.
Well, just to flip it in terms of him not liking it and thinking it's a career ender, after showing it buyers just a 40-minute edit of the film, the international rights sold in 5 minutes for the film. So
there you go.
You know, Stallone was maybe a bit off the thing there. But just to add to your authenticity of the film, you know the infamous sackcloth that he fashions out of the bit of tarpaulin?
Yeah. Right.
That wasn't a prop.
Right.
Location manager found that on location. It got used as a prop. So it's genuinely from.